This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is still not entirely sure what day of the week it is. I'm Kevin Day. He's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. I can see some questions in front of me, Kieran, so I guess it must be Monday. Happy New Year to you, Kieran. Happy New Year to all our listeners all over the world.
Yes. I hope 2022 is going to be a better year for everyone than 2021. I can't think... unless you were snogging Matt Hancock, it must have been a pretty bad year for everyone.
The trouble is, Kieran, that almost exactly a year ago, we were both saying, well, welcome to 2021, everybody. It can't be better, can't be worse, surely, than the year we just had. And lo and behold, it was.
Yes, it was.
But we've been kept sane by each other's company, Kieran, and by lots of lovely questions. So let's ask some of these lovely questions. A couple of familiar themes, Kieran, but I think this time of year, that's all right to revisit some familiar themes and talk about things that we can maybe put behind us. And the first question comes from Christopher Foster. And Christopher Foster, his question revolves around B Corp status businesses, which you did explain to me very patiently some stage last year. The new owners at my team, Grimsby Town, have stated that they would like to be the first football club to be recognised as having B Corp status, where directors are required to consider the impact of their decisions on workers, the environment, community, etc., which I, says Christopher, personally think is a brilliant idea. I'd like to know the thoughts of both Kevin and Kieran as to whether they also think it's a good idea and whether it should be the norm for all clubs and whether it is realistic. Well, Kieran will explain to some of our new listeners what B Corp actually is, but in short, I think, yes, it should be the norm for all clubs. Absolutely. I think it's a fantastic idea. It's long overdue for a lot of businesses. Whether it's realistic or not, Kieran, I'll leave up to you.
Yeah, I think you've actually nailed it there, Kevin. I mean, for people not familiar with B Corp status, it's the equivalent of fair trade for chocolate and coffee. It's companies who are involved in a particular industry acknowledging that there are more stakeholders in the industry than just the owners, and there's more to the business than just making a profit. And we already see that, I think, in football with respect to fan-owned clubs, with some owners who are fans who are in it for love rather than money. But I mean, the aims of B Corp, it's sort of a kite mark. It's sort of an aspirational status that some clubs might seek. Yeah, are they dealing with the club from an environmental, from a social, from a transparency, from a governance point of view? All of which are sort of nice fluffy buzzwords which resonate well. But if your side loses four games on the trot, then we normally turn to the pitchfork. So I think it is good. It's sort of halfway house between a traditional limited company and a charity, i.e. the company is trying to break even, it is trying to make money, but that's not the be-all and the end-all. And the arguments in favour of B Corp status is that you can actually be more you can be more successful, because if the focus is on the staff, if its focus is on the other stakeholders, such as the fans, keeping them happy, engaging with them, then that comes back as part of a virtuous circle. And I think if we take a look at those clubs that we make reference to on a regular basis, You know, the likes of Tranmere and Accrington and many others who do appear to notice that their fan base, you know, we're not going to be the most successful club in the world, so therefore we're going to have a close relationship with our fans, keep them informed, keep them engaged. When things turn bad, as we've seen during COVID, those fans turn around and say, right, we're putting our hands in our pockets, we're supporting the club, and so on. So I think it's got a lot of merit. Is it realistic in the world of Super League? I'm inclined to agree with you that there are some owners for whom the bottom line is the be all and end all. They've got a majority stake in the company, and they're not giving anything away.
Two questions, Kieran. First of all, is this a new idea? Who introduced this notion? Is it something that's always been floating around, or is it something like fair trade that a charity or an individual recognised the need for this and campaigned for it?
It's a recent phenomenon. Which has arisen because there is much more focus, I think, these days on organisations having some form of social responsibility, rather than just focusing on trying to make as much money in as short as time as possible and damn the consequences. And we've seen where that's got us. I think it can be viewed as sort of a relatively recent, progressive, hipsterish approach, and that's not being critical. You know, I think it's great. You know, and I think especially if you drop down the leagues, I think the more valid B Corps status or having the ideals of a B Corps organization at the elite level, the people involved, I can't see them wanting to engage with it.
Yeah, you see, hipsterish. It's quite difficult to say that, isn't it? I entirely agree with you. That's not a problem in itself, but it does sort of lead you to what the other problem is. My second question is that there's a lot of publicity over Christmas about one particular chocolate company, Tony's, who are drawing attention to, quite rightly so, to the way chocolate beans are produced, cocoa beans are produced, and the way some farmers are still exploited by big companies. But the trouble is that their product is almost twice as expensive as your normal Cadbury's bar. It's the same argument with organic chicken, for example. You and I are lucky enough, lucky enough to be able to afford proper organic, well-grown chicken. But for many people, the Sainsbury's £3 chicken is the only option. So that's the other problem with this, isn't it? It's not cheap to do, which is unfortunate. It's not cheap to run a club properly, is it?
It's not, but... Yeah, you know, what I absolutely agree with you in terms of food production, trying to have some form of enhanced welfare for the animals that you're then going to slaughter and eat, is expensive. It is more expensive than alternatives. So trying to find a happy medium is a challenge. I think in the nature of football clubs, it doesn't have to be. You know, being open and transparent, engaging with fans on a regular basis. Explaining decisions that doesn't cost clubs very much, so I can't see that necessarily being a negative for those clubs that just want to make money. That they would just see it as an irritation, and that brings us to another issue. You know, we're fully aware that some of the large organisations in the food industry are very good at box ticking, and they achieve that status. And you say, well, actually, you're not actually doing very much for the welfare of you know, individual farmers or farmers collectives or people in the industry. You are just doing it's the equivalent of a minimum wage. Yeah, the minimum wage is supposed to be a minimum, but it then becomes the norm in some industries.
We had a vegan friend round just before Christmas who, in the course of a conversation, asked whether I would kill and eat Smudge, my cat. And I said, well, no, of course I wouldn't, but which is very gracious of me because there are no circumstances in which Smudge would hesitate to kill and eat me. if we'd run out of whiskers, she'd be going straight for my throat. Now, our next question comes from Ian McLaughlin, my mother's maiden name. I don't think we can be related because Ian's a bit too English to be a name in my family. Well, we've got 27 Kevins, 38 Patricks, no Ians as far as I know. Very difficult at Christmas, Kieran. But Ian McLaughlin's question is a very interesting one. Ian says that he read recently that Mateus Fernandes is suing Barcelona after having his contract terminated. Now, how can a player's contract be terminated early when they haven't committed gross misconduct, like, for example, Adrian Mutu? Surely clubs can't just tear up a contract because of a bad purchase.
Yes, an intriguing one, this, and I think this is quasi-related to one of our later questions. Barcelona signed Mateus Fernandes for around about €8 million about 18 months ago. I think it's fair to say he didn't impress. His Barcelona career consisted of 17 minutes on the pitch.
Wow.
During that first season. I think he went out on loan as well. The downside was that, you know, having paid €8 million for him, they'd signed him on a five-year contract. So therefore, they were committed to paying wages. And as we've discussed this before, Barcelona have had to put through huge wage cuts in order to comply with La Liga rules. So what they did was that they said, we are sacking you for being rubbish, for poor performance, for effectively not trying. And what they've done here, and Barcelona's defence would be, we expect a de minimis level of commitment on a daily basis. And here are the metrics. You know, this is how far you were running during training, i.e., effectively, you're just taking the mickey. And that appears to be their viewpoint. Mateus Fernandes's viewpoint is, hold on, I stayed after training on regular occasions to try to improve certain elements of my skill base. I'm a committed professional. You're effectively saying I'm a wastrel, and you know that causes reputational damage. I want to be a professional footballer. So that's where we are at present. I think Ian's absolutely right. It doesn't strike me as gross misconduct. It strikes me as a bit of a duff signing, and you can't sack somebody for being not as good as his YouTube reel was when you bought him.
It's a strange one, Kira, because all not that I read them, but my agent tells me that all contracts for freelance jobs, for example, if I got news for you, they will have a clause that says you will do the job to the best of your ability.
But if
you weren't doing your job to the best of you, you would like to hope that management, first of all, would put an arm around you and say, is everything all right? Are you okay? And then you say, oh, I'm sorry about it. But it doesn't seem like that's happened in this situation. And if he gets the feeling early on that he's not wanted at the club, then I wouldn't run around the training pitch that much either. So it does feel like a failure of management, and as you say, a failure of recruitment, which is he's become the victim of as well, doesn't it? So
yeah, I agree with you totally. And it's being driven by Barcelona's desperation to get their wage bill down.
Ah, okay. Which will come back to bite them on the bottom if he gets granted a huge amount of money as compensation. Our next question comes from Matthew Gamble. I did toy with the idea, Kieran, of some puns here, but I think Matthew Gamble's probably had enough of those across his life. I was about to say, I bet he's had enough of those across his life, and then I'd be hoisting myself by my own betard. that's a clever little private eye pun there. Matthew Gamble's question is it's a question about something I've heard of, Kieran. I've been aware of it, but I don't really understand what it is. It's like the Sunday Times rich list. I don't care who's on it, but Matthew Gamble seems to agree with me because he says, why do we fetishize the annual Forbes most valuable clubs list? I've long thought as a young man, it never made any sense to me. And as I've got older, I've got a better understanding of things. It makes even less sense now. It would appear that most of it is driven by revenue. So how are these lists calculated? Is it revenue times a factor of something?
I fetishize about quite a few things, but the Forbes list has never been one of them. I actually contribute to Forbes for this because they phone me up and they will ask me on a regular basis about normally about three or four clubs about how I go about value, because I do valuation metrics. There are a variety of valuation methods. One is to say we're going to value each club at, you know, 2, 3, 4 times revenue. That's a very crude way of doing it, but it's sometimes it's the only way of doing it, especially if clubs aren't making profits. The other way to do it is to take your profits and say multiply them by 10, and that's the value of the club. There is a model which has been created by a former guest of the show who's now involved with Wigan Athletic, Tom Markham, called the Markham multivariate model. That's a little bit more sophisticated, and that can be used, but again, not everybody uses it. And then you've got everybody else. It's a bit like your mum's secret recipe for spaghetti bolognese, and nobody can make spaghetti bolognese like my mum. And I go, okay, mum, what's the secret? She's like, oh, well, I can't tell you everything, son. Yeah, I love you, but I don't love you that much. There are lots of firms of accountants, firms of advisors, firms of consultants say, well, we use a in-house method, and this is how we got our particular scores. And what they tend to do at Forbes is that they will contact quite a few providers of these things, and then they'll work out an average. So it is sometimes linked to revenue, as Matthew has said. My personal view is that there is perhaps an over analysis of the Forbes figure, simply because Forbes is itself got a very, very good reputation, but they don't do the calculations themselves. They tend to request them from third parties.
Mm. No one opened a tin of spaghetti bolognese better than my mum. She could open a tin. She could open two tins at once. She was the worst cook. It drives Ali up the wall because accidentally my mum made the best macaroni cheese in the world. Basically by cutting up two onions, some bacon, grating a huge lump of cheddar, chucking it all in with the macaroni and a pint of water and stirring it for about an hour, and it was the best macaroni and cheese ever. And it drives Ellie out the wall because she will spend the whole afternoon making this proper macaroni and cheese. And I go, what are you putting it in the oven for? What are you putting breadcrumbs on top of it? Don't do that, don't ruin it. You've cooked the onions. The onions have got to be half raw. The whole point of it is that you find one bit of macaroni that's not cooked at all and another bit that's literally water. is this Forbes list something that football clubs pay attention to? Is it something they compete with? Will Steve Parish be hoping to get Palace on it? Will your chairman be phoning up Everton's chairman today, we're above you? Is it something that's has any point at all?
I think it's one of these things which is done to fill space as much as anything else. The Deloitte list, I think people take a little bit more notice of some of the other firms now because ultimately football clubs are a bit like a work of art, and because they are not directly comparable, and they are unique. So just because one you'd have to pay more to buy Manchester United than you would have to buy Everton. You'd have to pay more probably to buy Everton than you would have to buy Palace and Brighton and so on. But we know that intuitively anyway. I think far too much emphasis is placed on these. But having said that, I do an annual review of valuations for the university, and that gets an awful lot of attention, which I'm not necessarily sure is always warranted, but people like tables and people like rankings, especially given the tribal nature of football. And I know one year I did a valuation and I put Burnley about seventh or eighth. And you think I'd burnt the flag or something, given the reaction of some fans.
Well, that leads us nicely, Kieran, onto our next question. And as producer guy can't possibly have known that Burnley would get mentioned in the Matthew Gamble question, he's not getting any credit for this. It's just totally accidental. Also not getting any credit, and I presume that this question comes from James Ashby and not Jemez. Yes. Ashby. if Jemez is your real name, I apologise to both you and producer guy, but James Ashby says, is there a league table of Premiership clubs sorted by income, expenditure, profit per league point? I'm guessing then that Burnley may be near the top and Everton near the bottom.
Well, there wasn't a league table of this until this question was set. So I had to get my spreadsheet out and produce one earlier today, and we're recording this on Sunday morning. And then having done it, and I was actually feeling quite smug having put in all of the data, produce all the tables, and then Windows 11 decided to freeze, so I had to switch the whole thing off, and now I've lost all of the data. So Microsoft are on my naughty step. Windows 11 is a bit rubbish. But I did manage to write down onto my mind map, of course, where everybody was. And in terms, we can't really do it on a profit basis because so many Premier League clubs lose money. But if we did, Burnley would be top. In terms of how much it costs to earn a point in terms of wages, it cost Chelsea £4.9 million per point.
Wow.
Last season. Yeah, that's hard. So they must have been really cheesed off when Danny Welbeck scored in the 93rd minute.
I knew you would engineer a way of mentioning that. I knew you would do that. If your football game has only lasted 90 minutes, you'd have been relegated already.
We would be indeed, yes. But the most successful team, the most productive team, is Aston Villa in terms of what they've achieved. So, I mean, this is a function of Villa not being in the Premier League that long, and therefore their wage bill is relatively low. But it only cost them £2 million in wages per point, and it was Villa and West Ham, because West Ham had a really good season last year. And their wage bill is, they only are paying on average £60,000 a week. Which for a side which finished so high in the Premier League actually made them very successful. So Villa and West Ham the most efficient, and Chelsea the least efficient based on the most up to date data.
So not only did you crowbar Danny Welbeck, and you found a spurious reason to mention West Ham as well.
Oh, sorry.
Very good. That's all right. That's all right. I thought you'd know me long enough to know how much I sulk about these things. Our next question comes from Sam Young. Sam says, in an interview with Ben Foster, brackets, yes, the pro goalie, close brackets, last year, hashtag United chairman Spencer Owen claimed that hashtag United are bigger than Southend United and any other team in Essex for that matter. Would the finances back this argument up? Now, hashtag United was something briefly, for sort of 2 months, was something everybody was talking about, and now less so. So it might be interesting, Kieran, if you remind people who hashtag United are before answering the question, although I would suspect it wouldn't take that much for their finances to beat any other team in Essex.
Yes, from a financial point of view, they are the most successful team because they actually make a profit. So I benchmark them against Southend and Colchester. I mean, they are playing in relatively, in about seventh or eighth tier. So from a financial point of view, they do okay. The fact that they break even, their average attendance is 292, which isn't great. I mean, I nearly went to Worthing yesterday, and they had over 2,000 at Worthing.
Brilliant.
Which is great. Not non-league football on Boxing Day or New Year's Day is a fantastic experience because it does help to blow the cobwebs away, and it's not at a stupid kickoff time. If we then look against compare them to Colchester, Colchester is really weird. Colchester is a club who, let's be honest, don't get a lot of attention. The last time I can really remember Colchester was when they beat Leeds United in the FA Cup in 70-71. They beat them 3-2. It was on Match of the Day. Yeah, one of those proper Match of the Day matches. They're a side that you'd think would be operating on a solid basis, but their losses are over £30 million. Yeah, whoever's underwriting those losses didn't get a lot of money. As for Southend, We don't know the state of Southend's finances because the owner, Ron Martin, has decided he can't be bothered to publish the accounts. So we've got nothing since 2019, but they were losing money there. But, you know, Colchester, they averaged 2,200 in terms of attendance. Southend, their attendances are quite volatile because I think some fans are starting to boycott matches because of Ron Martin's behaviour. And again, you know, as we've always said, if a club gets mentioned once on this podcast, that's normally quite a good thing, you know, because once they're getting mentioned once a month, as Southend United have been recently, that's not quite so good.
Hmm. I know I say this quite a lot on this pod, Kieran, but this is a plea to all our listeners. If you have any interest at all in the history of football, no matter what age you are, do a bit of research around that Colchester-Leeds game because it was the most amazing. Alan Clark, Don Revie made Alan Clark the centre-forward play despite the fact he had a temperature over 100 and was diagnosed with pleurisy the day after. He wouldn't let the players get changed afterwards, wouldn't let go to the dressing room, made them go straight to the coach, wouldn't shake the other manager's hand and blamed himself because he broke his usual routine. He let the players, I believe, fly for the first time to the game. It's remarkable, the circumstances around it. And I know Colchester fans will say, a lot more has happened to our club than that, but it is one of the most amazing FA Cup games ever, considering where Colchester were in the league and considering how mighty a team Leeds United were. But so hashtag United, Kim, just remind people the reason they were set up. Because initially... Because it was a kind of social media team, wasn't it? Because he said the chairman said he wasn't worried about getting fans in the ground, local fans. It was being financed by people all around the world. We should have done more research before we asked this question, Kieran, shouldn't we? It's the first one. Well, let's start the New Year's we mean to go on, Kieran.
Yes.
And why do you need to blow cobwebs away? You don't drink. You shouldn't have any cobwebs.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our next question comes from Alex Hemphill, and I'm pleased to see this question because I didn't, when you were talking before about Barcelona and it leads up to another question later on, I was trying to work out what Barcelona had to do with hashtag United or the Lion of Vienna, but I just didn't notice this one. Alex Hemphill says, I think we have discussed this before, but as I say, in the spirit of looking back on times gone by before we move ahead, does La Liga have a pay cap? And if so, can you explain how it works, please?
Yeah, well, first of all, it most certainly does have a pay cap. La Liga have an army of around about 20 accountants who do an awful lot of forensic work. And the reason why the pay cap exists was around about 9 or 10 years ago, there were many La Liga clubs who were in genuine danger of going out of business. So therefore, they decided to introduce the pay cap. And the way that it works is that it takes into consideration, first of all, how much money does a club generate. Secondly, it looks at the financial commitments. So it looks at what are the short-term debts of the club. So if you have any loans which are due for repayment, also if you've got outstanding transfer fees, then it sort of deducts those, and whatever's left over goes into a little it goes into a little calculator, goes into a little algorithm, and that spits out your wages for the year. And Barcelona this year, I think their wage bill is limited to around about 80 million. quid, which is, you know, it was around about 400 to 500 million fairly recently. Real Madrid, who have kept their finances in order, that their wage bill is about 6 or 7 times that of Barcelona. I know people will be saying, well, hold on, you know, Barcelona have just signed a player from Manchester City for £55 million. How's that going to be financed? What Barcelona have done over the course of the last 6 months is that they've managed to convert some of their short-term loans into long-term loans, which has some advantages, certainly has advantages as far as the pay cap is concerned, but it does, of course, mean that you're paying more money in interest over a longer period of time, which, yeah, it's a type of deal my Uncle Terry would approve of, because it means he can come knocking on your door on a more regular basis. So that's how it works. It's your revenue less your day-to-day running costs. Then it takes into consideration your debts, which are due over the course of the next 12 months. So Barcelona have managed to refinance some of their debts, and this is now going to give them a bit more leeway in terms of their ability to pay wages. They have the seventh highest wage cap in La Liga. It certainly has some merits in terms of preventing clubs from going bust. But what it also does is it very much reinforces the existing gaps between clubs in general. But, you know, we are working in exceptional times at present from a financial perspective, you know, on the back of COVID. Barcelona in particular used to make an absolute fortune, not only on match days, but from the museum, from hospitality and so on. And they've taken a huge hit.
Slightly distracted during that question, Kieran, by this pleasing image of you dressed as the Duke of Wellington riding a horse at the head of an army of accountants. Just imagine the scouts coming back saying, how many of the enemy are there? 40,000 to 60,000. Seasonally adjusted, let's go 55,000. And talking of COVID, unfortunately, I really wish we didn't have to. Jamie Mercer says, on a recent podcast you did with Lion of Vienna, I presume that's a Preston podcast, Kieran, is it?
Yes.
You said that you predicted an Armageddon of clubs going bust throughout the pandemic and seemed surprised and pleased, I guess, that one hadn't. In my opinion, though, says Jamie, I think the Armageddon is coming, but not yet, as clubs have been protected by things such as government grants, furlough, low-interest loans, etc. In the not-so-distant future, when these support packages are no longer available, I think that's when clubs will sadly hit the wall. Would you agree with this? Now, I do remember right back at the start of this terrible pandemic, we discussed the fact that you thought that there are possibly up to 40 clubs that were, you thought, in short-term danger. And luckily that hasn't transpired. But it's an interesting point from James. Do you think that this is an issue that it could take a year, 2 years, 3 years before it actually the final effects show themselves?
Well, I was certainly very concerned, unless there was some form of financial support. And I need to. I think we said Preston. We should, of course, said Bolton.
For Bolton. Line of Vienna. I beg your pardon. Sorry, that's my my fault. Sorry.
We know our listeners hold us to account.
Yeah. No. Preston's Tom Finney. That Lofthouse is Bolton. Yes. Beg your pardon.
If there had been no financial support for clubs in the lower league, I think there would have been tens of clubs that would have had to have gone out of business or would have suffered significantly. What we have seen is that whilst there's been no direct government support for the industry, all of the clubs outside of the Premier League have tended to use furlough, and I think that's the right thing to do. In addition, clubs in Leagues 1 and 2 have been able to access grants from the Premier League, and I think the Premier League deserves some credit. I think they should have done this, but they did it. That's the important thing. That has helped those clubs to survive. But Jamie's absolutely right in that as we're coming out of it, clubs still have wages to pay. They've still got the PAYE and the national insurance on those wages to pay. HMRC are taking an increasingly hard line for people who are being late. So we're not out of the woods yet. You know, clearly it's the tragedy of what's happened at Derby is is a cause for concern. And I think HMRC will be reluctant to reach some form of deal in terms of the outstanding tax, which is due, because then they then fear that the football industry would try to use this on a regular basis. At the same time, in my view, it's more important that we have a Derby County, because that allows them to pay wages in future, which means that HMRC will get money coming from PAY in future. So yeah, it's going to be a tough negotiation, that one. Football is remarkably resilient. And there have been so many good instances of owners stepping up, of fans rallying around clubs and effectively donating their season ticket money and saying, yeah, okay, we'll take iFollow as an alternative from that. We love our club and we don't want this Armageddon. And by lots of people from lots of parts of football doing their bit, and that comes from the very top down to individual fans, we've managed to get through to where we are today.
While we're on this subject, Kieran, if anybody from the Premier League is listening, if you could kindly explain to us the exact criteria by which games are called off because of the unavailability of players, I'd be very grateful, because fans are getting really pissed off out there. There's utter confusion as to what needs to happen before a game is called off. Norwich fans, for example, I spoke to, I mean, they were decimated. Their squad was decimated against us, and yet it seemed there was no listening to from the Premier League to their request for postponing games. And yet other clubs, it seems, have two or three people with tickly throats and their games are called off. It's causing some resentment amongst fans as well. Because all we want to know, as you always talk about transparency, just tell us what the criteria is by which a game isn't happening. Because otherwise, people are falling out with each other about this, and it's very confusing.
Yeah, I was going to say that we've had Neil Doncaster from the SPFL come on twice, and I think Neil, we're going to have another Ask the SPFL. Yeah. We're hoping to get Trevor back from the EFL with an Ask the EFL show. And it would be really good if the Premier League did the same. So producer guy, I think, or myself, we'll get in contact with them. And we say, we know you're a pussycat as an interviewer. You always said you're not Paxman. We're nice people. And it would be good, I think, if the Premier League could open up. And it's not, we're not after the ratings or anything. I think it's absolutely essential in terms of, there's been some bad stuff from the Premier League clubs over the course of the last couple of years. And this is the chance for the organisation itself to say, we're doing lots of good. And we've given them praise when they've done well as well.
It's getting ludicrous. Christmas, I was actually, all the Palace WhatsApp groups, all these rumours, Conor Gallagher is having to eat in the car because he's not vaccinated. Or he's been in contact, and it's, how do you know this? It's Christmas night. Who's telling you these things? 3 o'clock in the morning, we hear Palace have asked the Premier League to cancel the game at 3 o'clock in the morning. How do you know this? But is all these rumours going around that Palace were one test away from having the game called off? And the thing is that people are preparing to go to the game. They want to get ready and travel. They're looking forward to games over the Christmas period. And it's absolutely right. If people are ill or have to isolate, then of course the game shouldn't go ahead. But it just seems that some games are going ahead for when they shouldn't, and some games aren't going ahead when they should. So, and all it takes, as you say, is just come and tell. Don't have to tell us. Just tell Gary Lineker, and he can tell us. Mm. It's otherwise, speculation just grows into rumour, which grows into unease, and that's how I can't remember what comes after that, Kieran. But there you go. BAFTA have gone again, haven't they? Our penultimate question comes from John Brennan. And I think this is a really interesting question, Kieran, and I'm intrigued to hear what you think the answer is. As John says, while watching tennis last year, we'll forgive you for that, John, it struck me that each player has their own kit sponsors. Now, doing something similar in football could be very lucrative for clubs and players. For example, they split revenue 25-75 from a sleeve sponsor or advertiser. You've mentioned before there are limits to the amount of advertising allowed on shirts. Thank God we're not France. But is there anything in the rules to prevent different players on the same team having different sponsors? Now, I can see a situation, Kieran. where John's got a point. You know, the clubs, the players all have the same sponsor on the shirt front, but why not have a different sponsor on the sleeve?
Because the shirt belongs to the club.
Ah,
and okay. If you go to the Premier League handbook, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend this on a bank holiday Monday in January, although there might not be nothing more exciting to do, then the rules are very, very specific as to the amount of advertising. It's, you know, even the size of the logo on the front of the shirt, the size of the logo on the sleeve of the shirt. One of the sleeves is reserved for the Premier League badge itself. And remember, we saw recently with UEFA preventing Ajax from using the Bob Marley
shirt. True, yeah.
And that was just the wording on the neck. So you know, these things are monitored very, very carefully. In terms of players and generating revenue, well, they tend to do that on sort of personal image rights deals, where if at present we've got Cristiano Ronaldo, he's advertising for one of those apps which gives you updates on scores. And if you notice, he's wearing a plain white shirt. You know, it's not a Manchester United shirt. It's not a Portugal shirt, because they would want a proportion of the money if he was wearing the shirt. And also, it would have to be a deal coming through the club as opposed to the individual. So individual players can sign deals to use their likeness, to use themselves, but they can't use the club merchandise at the same time.
I suppose it would be a bit embarrassing, wouldn't it, if Wilfried Zaha, for example, had his sleeve sponsored by Nationwide Building Society, and Joel Ward had Thornton Heath Veterinary Surgeon on his sleeve. It would be a little bit embarrassing. Our final question comes from friend of the show, Brentford fan Stuart Hatcher. Stuart says, when the debate raised about the best England football song last summer, brackets, not sure why, as the answer is obvious, New Order, well done, Stuart. Not even going to close the brackets on that one because it's perfectly obvious. It made me wonder what has been the most successful football song, Heart, Hoddle and Waddle, Living in Luxury Under Diamond Lights as a result of royalties. Is the Anfield rap still making anyone money? We need to know. What I can tell you, Stuart, is that I won't tell you what show, but we wanted to entice Chris Waddle one to see if he would sing Diamond Lights. And some producers would say, I can't even ask him, it'd be too embarrassing. Surely it's like, it's 5 seconds it took him to say yes. But it turns out that on his own, it turns out the Hoddle did a lot of the heavy lifting in the singing of that song. That's all I will tell you. Can we work out an answer to this? It's an interesting question.
Absolutely. In terms of sales and royalties, it's your two friends from your profession. It's Badil and Skinner.
Of course.
Because it's been out on a regular basis. It's been number one more than once.
Of course.
And not only is it popular here in England, if you ever go to Germany, German fans have adopted it as well. So yeah, it's by a street. It's the most successful in terms of royalties, and the people involved have got it. Yeah, it's a bit like Noddy Holder with his Christmas song.
Is it possible to work out, I wonder, Kieran, where on that list Bring a Pal to Palace, the anthem from the '70s? would fit. I think it was called that. All power to that. Oh, home or away. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, that would be very kind of you. Please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. Thank you for listening. Happy New Year again. In the meantime, I shall hand you over for the customary farewell for Mr. Kieran Maguire.
Well, thanks again, gang, for all your support. If you want to use Patreon, we're very kind, very grateful. If you just want to send us some good karma, and Kevin and I genuinely have no idea how this works, but if you can give us a review, Spotify, you can now give reviews there as well, or using the Apple icon. If you think the show's good, give us 5 stars. If you don't think it's good, then tell us. You know, we're old and ugly enough to be able to cope with this. You don't have to say nice things you could save if you prefer. You'd rather the show was produced or presented by Rick Astley and Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to us, but it does help us in the ratings somehow, and that's all that matters.
Rick Astley is one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. I can't vouch for Skippy. He tuts a lot, doesn't he, Skippy?
He does.
No, he always seems to be sarcastic, but yeah. Although he's handy if you've got a small child who's fallen down a well shaft. Skippy's very good at that sort of thing. If you don't like the show, don't tell me. I'm a performer. I can't take negative criticism. Tell Kieran and Guy by all means, and then they don't tell me. So I just happily go through the world thinking, well, this must be the most popular pod ever. No one ever complains. It's because Kieran and Guy don't tell me if they do. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The price of football. Price of football.